CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 126, with Dr. Bob Osher revisited. He is the godfather of ophthalmic surgical videos and has taught me so much that improved my surgery and my life. I was recently on a podcast where they asked me which one surgeon has had the biggest impact and influence in my career and in my life in ophthalmology. And there's no question. Check it out.
It has never actually helped me directly in the operating room, but he taught me by videos. And that is the godfather of surgical video for ophthalmology, which is Dr. Robert Osher, Bob Osher.
Bob Osher is an incredible man. He has literally single-handedly changed the way that tens of thousands of surgeons operate and therefore has helped millions of patients. He's a true visionary in our field and is really an incredible human being. Now, I even had a chance to play golf with him recently, and take a look, he's a fantastic golfer. He basically golfs scratch, par, every hole. He's incredible, but it's just his personality because he learned golf later in life, but was so intense about it that he went and practiced so much that he became an incredible golfer in a short period of time. You can do the same for cataract surgery. Forget golf. Cataract surgery is actually much more fun, at least for me. But listen to this podcast. Really, it's a replay of podcast number one. Why is this podcast number one? Because that's how important he is to me in my career. So, dear Bob, I thank you so much again for all you've done for me and you continue to do. You are such an incredible mentor, and I can never repay the gift you've given me. But check out the podcast. I promise you will love it and you will learn a lot. So I want to welcome Bob Osher to our Cataract Coach as the inaugural podcast interview. And as I call him, Bob is the godfather of ophthalmic surgical video and my number one mentor in my entire career. I've learned so much from him. So welcome, Bob. We're going to have a fantastic podcast and I have so much to talk to you about.
Thank you, Uday. It's a real honor to be here, and I'm going to mention to your viewers that we've tried this once before, and after a lovely interview, we realized I had not pressed the button for the sound, so I'm going to try to do a little better this time, so yours.
That's all about the tenacity. You know, one thing I definitely want to talk about in our interview today is a little bit about this book that you wrote, which I think is fantastic, What I Say. And the second one is the ABCs. We definitely want to talk about these. But I just want to tell you that when I was a resident in the late 1990s, I stumbled across a VHS tape, which for the young people is this plastic box that has a magnetic tape that has like low definition video. And I was blown away because I, at that point, realized like, number one, I'm not doing retina anymore. There's no chance. I'm doing cataract surgery because I love cataract surgery. And number two, I realized that that's the way you learn. There's only so much I can pick up from listening to a lecture if there's no video or reading a technique in a book. So tell me, how did you get the idea to start a video journal for cataract, refractive, and now glaucoma surgery?
I finished my residency at Bascom Palmer and then completed three additional fellowships at Bascom Palmer and at Wills, and I still felt incredibly insecure. I would still be training if my wife hadn't told me that I had to go out and get a job. So I went back to Cincinnati to join my father, who was a cataract surgeon in a very small little practice. And my dad objected to my getting on a plane every week to go watch a cataract surgeon somewhere. I would fly to the West Coast and watch Bob Sinsky and Dick Kratz. I would fly to South and watch Norm Jaffe and Henry Clayman. And I would go East and watch the man himself, Charlie Kelman. I'd go to the Midwest, watch Jimmy Little. And I really wound up spending a lot of money and a lot of time trying to pick up a pearl here and there. And right about that time, video was just coming out. Some of the blockbuster videos were, the stores were starting to pop up. And I said, wouldn't it be great if instead of me traveling everywhere, if I could do a video program where people sent me their videos and we could watch and learn right in the comfort of our own living room. So the video journal began actually in 1983. I didn't get the first issue out until 85. And like you said, it was on very large VHS tape. And I would take hundreds of these tapes in great big suitcases to the meetings and disseminate them. And of course, we've all seen this massive transition of technology. It's evolved so magnificently over the years. And fortunately, I don't have to do that anymore, pay all those luggage fees. And I think that video has really stood the test of time. Clearly, it's much easier to learn watching a video than it is by listening to a surgeon at a podium or reading something in a textbook. I still enjoy teaching from a podium and writing in a textbook, but there's no question that video is a much more effective way to learn.
And you've evolved through the years, started with VHS and then actually Betamax and 3/4 inch tape, then to DVDs and now to online digital streaming at any point. And you reach basically every ophthalmologist on the planet.
Yeah, we're a free member benefit of every cataract society in the world. And the videotapes did produce a lot of interesting situations. I can remember being invited to speak in Lima, Peru. And I took down literally a chest of videos, and I got there, and they didn't have a 3/4 inch player in the entire country. Boy. So it's a heck of a lot easier to do now. But I think that we're very fortunate, Uday. We've seen not only a technology explosion in video, but we've also seen that in the operating room with all of our phaco equipment and our intraocular lenses. And I'm so glad I chose ophthalmology for many, many reasons, but I don't think there would be that same explosion of technology had I chosen, for example, proctology.
good thing you didn't choose proctology. I don't know if I want to watch proctology videos at 7 in the morning. But you've also expanded beyond cataracts. It was cataract initially, then it became more refractive, now glaucoma. I mean, the spectrum is really very wide.
I've been very lucky to be surrounded in my career by exceptional ophthalmologists. And George Waring told me that I needed to expand to refractive. And Mike Snyder told me that I had to put in more prosthetic iris material. And Graham Barrett told me that, and Ike Ahmed forced me to introduce glaucoma. So I've been heavily influenced by our little editorial board, and I do all the work, and they give me the ideas, which have been greatly appreciated.
Yeah, it's such an incredible learning resource that I still am a huge fan of today. We'll put a link down below for any of our fans who want to have a direct access to it. I also want to talk about a lot of your innovations. You have innovated countless things in our field, and things that at the time were very controversial, but now are like the norm, such as treating astigmatism at the time of cataract surgery. That was, to me, it seems so natural, and it's what I've always done. Tell me, why was that such a big deal? Why was there so much controversy?
Well, in the early 1980s, several things happened. The first was I went to the AIOIS, which was the precursor of the ASCRS, and I said, I'm young, and I really need, I'm hungry to learn, but every case I see that's presented is a perfect case. And that's certainly not real life in my operating room. I was breaking capsules left and right, to be honest with you.
As we all do.
Yeah, well, back then we had the phaco 9000, which was only 1% of us were doing phaco, and that had two speeds or two options. It had maximum, which would suck the entire patient off the table, and it had minimum, and you'd have to look at the calendar on the wall to see anything happening. So, you know, I went to the companies and I said, I'm very interested in letting me be in control.
Sure.
I don't want the machine to think for me. I would like to have a surgeon control option and Cooper Vision. And that was actually even before Alcon took over. They said, who the hell are you? And they sent me packing. I finally found a small company in Italy called Opticon that allowed me to make a machine called the phaco Gold. And it had the first surgeon-controlled ultrasound aspiration rate, vacuum, and I even developed an automated IV pole that allowed me to control it up and down with my foot with GEDMED in St. Louis. So that was quite controversial, but nowhere near as controversial as when I went and I said, I want to start a video symposium. And they said, what is a video symposium? I said, I want to put together a panel and I will show real life cases of my complications. I'll be happy to show you my dirty laundry because I think surgeons will really learn a lot compared to just seeing one perfect case after another at every meeting. So I assembled the first faculty, which was Charlie Kelman, Norm Jaffe, Bill Simcoe, David McIntyre, and maybe one other. I don't remember who it was, but they were all the, and I the showed my, these were the icons. I was the new kid on the block, and I showed my cases, and at the very end, you know, having kept everybody in the audience on the edge of their seats for 2 hours, Norm Jaffe came up to me and he said, you'll have to probably do better next time. and that became like this, that was the standard, because the following year in 83, I realized that so many surgeons were, we were really impressed with astigmatism. Cliff Terry introduced his keratometer on the microscope and technology was just starting to develop about astigmatism. And I realized a couple of things. I realized, number one, emmetropia was the holy grail. Sure. And I realized that everybody was paying attention to inducing astigmatism. Nobody was paying attention to getting rid of pre-existing astigmatism.
Sure.
And I just happened to be involved with the Keratorefractivist Society at that time, learning about radial keratotomy, which my chief at Bascom Palmer, Ed Norton, told me that when I left to learn the first few cases that were being done in the United States, I went to watch on my own vacation time. He told me that if I continue, I would be expelled as a resident. That's how malignant everyone was about refractive surgery at that time.
They don't want you to ever touch the cornea, was the saying, right?
Well, wait till you hear the rest of the story. I went ahead in 1983 to the Cataract Congress in Houston, and I showed 70 cases of pre-existing astigmatism where I had put relaxing incisions, which I called astigmatic keratotomy, on the cornea. And I showed how the vast majority of this group was able to achieve uncorrected 20/40 vision or better. And at that time, nobody said uncorrected. Sure. It was all about kicking a cataract out with Nike cleats and then 6 weeks later measuring the eye corrected vision, and if you were 20/40 or better, you were a hero. I said, that's no good. One of the most controversial papers I wrote was on uncorrected vision in 1986, and I was very, very much criticized for that paper about the importance of early uncorrected vision. But getting back to astigmatic keratotomy, I showed this patient, and they used to have at the Cataract Congress like this game Hollywood Squares where they had nine very powerful icons sitting up, and then they would constructively criticize your presentation. Well, at the end of my presentation, I waited for applause, and there wasn't a single clap in the house.
Oh, wow.
This was 1,000 people in the Welsh Cataract Congress in Houston. So then after a few moments of sweat starting to pop up on my forehead.
I can only imagine.
Again, my mentor at Bascom Palmer, Norm Jaffe, said, I'm ashamed that you were a resident at Bascom Palmer. I can't believe that you're doing this stuff. And then Jan Wurst, who was the icon in Europe, he stood up, he says, young Osher, we have cut virtually every tissue on the body except the cornea, and now you're mutilating that.
and it
actually went downhill from there.
Oh, boy.
So I can remember the next presentation I made was in San Diego. And there was a bus that I took back to my hotel. And I got to tell you, I hate to admit this, but I was so criticized because at that meeting, I also talked about clear lensectomy for high hyperopia.
Which we do all the time now.
And that was just absolutely off the... I mean, that was punishable by death. And I was in the back of this bus, a city bus, going back to my hotel, and I was weeping. I said, I'll never be able to be accepted by my peers, no matter how much I want to contribute. I'm the Uriah Heep. I'm being ostracized at a very young age. And I felt an arm come around me, and this was the first of two arms in my career. This was from Spencer Thornton. And he said, whatever you did today shocked everybody, and please don't give up. He says, my name is Spence Thornton, and I'm very interested in refractive surgery, and what you did today has influenced me. And I'm probably the senior refractive surgeon in this society. Sure. And that was one time. And then the next time was when I was in Brazil a few months later. It was one of my first international trips. And I had a real wonderful opportunity to talk about clear lensectomy for high hyperopia, astigmatic keratotomy for pre-existing astigmatism, surgeon-controlled phaco. And then I showed how if you tear the posterior capsule, you can still put a posterior chamber lens in, which no one had ever done. And at the end of the presentation, again, there was no support, no applause, no nothing. And I went back, I sat in my seat, and I said, well, that was a hell of a lot of money I just spent to come to Brazil, you know, to be rejected. And an arm came around me. It was Charlie Kelman. He says, I want to talk to you. And I looked at him. I said, oh, my God, that's Dr. Kelman. Please don't beat me up. And, you know, he pulled me out. He says, you're going to have a very difficult early part of your career, because I did the same thing. I said things that nobody wanted to hear, and I was ostracized. I was banished. And he says, you know, he gave me so much kindness, so much warmth, and so much support. From that day on, he was my second father. And of course, my first father, my real father, was always very supportive in a very quiet way in Cincinnati. And in fact, when I told my dad I wanted to develop the Cincinnati Eye Institute, which was he and me, and I wanted to, I said, you know, I have a vision of having our own surgery center, where we are no longer under the control of the hospital, and we can bring in fellowship-trained ophthalmologists who will be able to do one thing really well. My dad, who was very supportive, responded by saying, I'm going to have you psychologically tested for 3 days.
And then you were off the curve for loyalty and ambition.
They found out that I was very average in everything, but I had two spikes.
Sure.
I was extremely, well, we sat around the table when they gave us these reports after 3 days of undergoing testing. They said, yeah, you've got two spikes. The first is ambition. He says, we've only tested one other person who's as ambitious as you. Wow. And that was Dr. Jonathan Tu, who at that time was the president of the American Academy of Neurosurgery. And of course, by that time, we had hired a couple of other ophthalmologists who were my colleagues, and they all were sweating bullets when they heard that. But then they said, "Your second spike we've never had with the first one, and that's loyalty."
Sure.
And they looked at my partners. They said, "This guy's going to protect you and have your back for the rest of your career." So they agreed to let me become the first medical director of Cincinnati Eye Institute. I went on to hire about 50 fellowship-trained ophthalmologists. We became the largest eye institute in the United States.
Sure.
And the entire time, we believed in high-quality care. We believed in doing the best for the patient. And that was always my dad's philosophy, was so treat the patient like family.
Of course.
And that's exactly what we did. And that's why we grew like crazy.
Well, you're saying the patients don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
And that was my expression. You stole that from me from that last interview.
Because I'm your disciple. I copy everything.
I put that on a big board that when the surgeons and the employees entered, every single one said, they saw right there, patients don't care how much you know until they know how much you care your medical director.
I copied you on a lot of things. I still give every patient my cell phone number. You know why? Because you taught me that.
That's right. That's right. I've always felt there's success, no matter what you're doing, is 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. And if you really work your hardest and you're always giving every patient your best, there's no shortcuts. you're going to be successful. And that's a lesson that I wish every youngster could learn.
What is it about ophthalmology where it seems like some of the most important pioneers in our field, you, Ridley, Kelman, Fyodorov, ridiculed or ostracized at the beginning of their careers and then later worshipped? Why?
Well, I've never been worshipped. I can promise you that.
Well, a little bit by me.
My kids, they tolerate their dads staying up till 2 in the morning.
Well respected. Then let's go from ridiculed to well respected.
Okay. All right. Okay.
We
have a dangerous bit of humanity that is to fear the unknown.
Sure.
We all have a comfort zone. And when I see people doing extracapsular surgery, they're very comfortable with it. They didn't want to enter phaco because it took them outside their comfort zone. And then the way you stay comfortable is you often criticize or throw stones at those who have very different beliefs. And we're all like that. Oh. That's, you know, we all heard. And, you know, so some of us who hear a little different drummer, you know, we will pay the dues. And I think that if you look at all those people you mentioned, they were banished. They were criticized. And that's one thing that Charlie told me. He said, you're really going to have to toughen up. You're going to have thicker skin than you've got. And I think as a result of that over the years, my whole philosophy about being criticized has changed.
Yeah.
I welcome the criticism now because, you know, if I send a paper in and it's rejected by one of the journals, I know it's probably a pretty good paper.
Yeah, that's your sign that it's threatening the status quo or the dogma. Or as you say, today's dogma may be tomorrow's dog food.
That's right. That's another one of my favorite expressions. And
well, there's other things too that people may not realize. In the old days of phaco versus extracap manual surgery, you got a lot of grief for being a pioneer of phaco and a dense cataract or loose zonules or small pupil or weak corneal endothelium. Everyone said, no, only extracap. But you said, I can do phaco.
Well, I had an advantage, a little bit of an advantage, because I had a machine, which was probably one of the few machines that I could control.
Sure.
So Charlie had 5 contraindications to phaco in all of his books, and you mentioned them. It was the mature lens, the shallow chamber, the weak cornea, the small pupil,
and
the loose lens.
Yeah.
Okay, I tackled every one of those. I wrote every single initial paper in each of those areas, and even to this day, people like Dr. Manus Kraft, who ran the Cataract Society, it wasn't the ASCRS, it was the MSCRS, Manus's Society, they still criticize to this day the fact that we were doing loose lenses. And I was so fortunate because, again, I had Bob Cioni as a fellow. And Bob and I tackled these cases, and we brought in the first capsular tension rings
smuggled
in the United
them.
States.
You're a smuggler.
We were a smuggler. You betcha. If you look in that book, you'll see pictures of me in a garbage can taking a package from a passerby.
CTRs, specialty IOLs, viscoelastic, iris prosthesis. You smuggled everything.
I did. I brought in the first Tripan Blue, the first black lenses, the first Helon 5. There was just a number of things, but I was severely criticized for loose lenses. And it wasn't until Jerry Emery, who was a very respected surgeon from Tennessee, started to do phaco with loose lenses. The other advantage that I had, which I can't emphasize enough, was I was surrounded by a small support group. My original video symposium that we took all over the world was Doug Koch, Dick Lindstrom, Roger Steinert, Sam Maskett, and Alan Crandall.
Wow, all stars.
And we were all young, and we were all committed, and they gave me so much support. To this day, I'm so grateful to all of them. They each became the president of the Cataract Society, and I never served on a single committee.
Well, there you go. You and me both. Sometimes you got to do things your own way.
So I have to tell you, the very first time I showed how to put a posterior chamber lens in a torn capsule, it was at the AAO meeting. And it was so dramatic that I did not get invited back for 10 full years.
What?
So you do pay the price. You really, really do pay the price when you think differently. And I interviewed Harold Ridley, and he said to me, it's a very early issue of the Video Journal, I'm so glad I lived long enough to see things come full circle.
Sure.
And because when you're hated, no matter how tough your skin is, it's not a good feeling. Especially when you're just a young, naive kid, and you just want to, your whole goal in ophthalmology, beside patient care, is to just make the place a better specialty, to contribute to something. And my dad instilled that in me. So it was certainly tough, but, you know, I'm very forgiving, and I hold really no grudges. Most of the people who really were rude and tough to me, they've passed on. So I've outlived the group. I will tell you, though, it made a big difference in the way I taught, because teaching to me was really important, and I grew up in a very punitive system. People were really tough. And I spent much of my residency being reprimanded in Dr. Ed Norton's office, who was the chief and the president of the AAO. But I was a truth seeker. I wanted to know. And maybe I wasn't very diplomatic, but I always wanted to find out why something was taught the way it was taught and how to make it better. And I think that's something I instill in my residents. And I also don't believe in a punitive approach. I believe in a very supportive approach, giving them fertile ground for their ideas, some of which are good and many of which are not. But they at least can discuss it. And I've told every single resident over all of these years at the University of Cincinnati that your obligation is to prove me wrong and to come up with a better way of doing it.
Correct.
Just come up with a better way. And I think that that's the proper way to encourage people to make change. Because, you know, the only thing that's constant is change.
Oh, in our field, especially in ophthalmology, especially cataract and refractive and glaucoma, the anterior segment, certainly if you're operating the same way today as you did 10 years ago, you're far behind. It's got to keep evolving.
And one of the things I admire most about you, Uday, is you've had this commitment to teaching. And this requires a massive amount of time that people just don't realize. Teaching is a privilege. Taking care of patients is a privilege.
Sure.
I love what I do. People ask all the time, when are you going to retire? The next 10 guys at Cincinnati Institute, younger than me, have all retired. And I say, what am I going to do that I enjoy better? What's more wonderful than being able to help a patient recover their vision? And this, I feel like I hit the lotto. It's such a privilege to do what we do. And I say, I do have an exit strategy. It's called death. and up until then, as long as I can remain competent, and I have to brag just for a small moment.
No, please.
I just looked at all of my cases from this year, and I don't do the volume that I used to do by any stretch. But this year, I had zero complications. Here's the thing. Number one is I manage unusual things. I recognize things sooner. I know how to manage them sooner. I do fewer cases. But we have a barometer, unlike most fields. Yes. Most fields, you don't know if you're losing your competency. We have a barometer because we have to report, at least that we do at Cincinnati Institute, every complication. So the moment I start to see my skills deteriorate, I will know when it's time to become a medical ophthalmologist, or perhaps one of my old loves, a neuro-ophthalmologist.
That's right. That was your first fellowship in med school was the neuro-ophthalmology one.
Yeah, that was a magnificent opportunity to spend time with Lawton Smith, who loved his patients.
Sure.
He was such a role model. And Norm Schatz up at Wills, who loved his patients. I'm telling you, I was so lucky. Because the influence teachers had on me and on you is a reason we want to give back and do the same thing for our youngsters.
Oh, for sure. For sure. In fact, it's this book. Part of the difficulty in learning ophthalmology is learning how to actually talk or speak with patients. That's a huge challenge. I found this book 20 years into my career, and I read every word twice.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. It wasn't my idea to write that book. I take no credit. That was a young fellow from Alabama by the name of Jack Parker who came up and he said, "Can I watch you in surgery?" And he then asked the question, "Do you mind if I stay for a week and write down everything that you're talking to patients?" Because yeah. I do use humor, and for I'm sure. not afraid to reassure.
For sure.
And I want to make sure they know I'm in their camp.
Yeah.
And I'm not afraid to touch somebody's shoulders. Our younger people right now could communicate wonderfully, but it's by text.
Yeah. You know,
they've lost the art is being able to look a patient in the eye and make that patient know, again, as we've said before, how much you really care. And in 40 some odd years, I've never had a single lawsuit because every patient knows they are a part of my family. And I give each one, as you said, my cell phone. Sure. And they know that I will not abandon them. No matter what the situation is, I'm on their side.
That's so critically important. But I also love the other aspects, how where you have that compassion and that love, but the other aspects of your personality too are very fascinating to me. People may not know, you've coached like 100 youth sports teams, maybe more, like a crazy number.
Well, I will talk about that, but before we switched and transitioned to that, I want to just say a few more things about teaching.
Tell me.
You know, there are so many ways people can teach. And, you know, you don't have to be comfortable at a podium. You don't have to be comfortable as an author. But working with residents is fantastic. And you did it for 20 years. You did it. And that's probably how you got all your great videos from your residents.
But, and gray hair.
Right. I hear you. I think that I have a column now in the JCRS every month. It's a wonderful opportunity to teach young surgeons. I'm so honored that the JCRS has given me that opportunity. And yet a lot of things weren't invited. For example, I started a meeting which became the second largest cataract meeting in the United States, Cataract Surgery Talent Like It Is, of which you were honored 1 year.
Sure.
But that meeting was because I chaired the Hawaii session for decades. And one day I was chairing a session and mentioned a few names of companies.
Wait, you got to say, the session was new technologies. And how could
That's
you talk
exactly
about
right.
It makes no sense. How could you talk about a new technology without saying a company name?
That's exactly right. Well, I violated these very new strict CME guidelines in January, and I had just given the exact same course at the AAO, which is the most conservative body on the planet, and no one had said a word there, but I got dinged, and they told me that I had violated a zero-tolerance situation where I was going to be punished, and maybe suspended for a year, and I didn't give them a chance to give me that suspension. I said, I'll just start my own meeting where we can say whatever the hell we want to say and teach just exactly how we want to teach.
You are five standard deviations above the mean in ambition, so we will give you that.
So I took a small group of colleagues to Sarasota, and we had three or four sponsored companies. And 10 years later, we had north of 600 ophthalmologists and 118 companies. And then I realized this was way, way, way too much for me.
It's a lot of work.
I was tired of picking out the desserts and hiring the security people. And then I would get an urgent call in the middle of the night. You know, what do we do? The Zeiss microscope is stuck in the freight elevator. And there was such a massive amount of work that I sold the meeting to Slack. And I'm so glad and relieved I did because now I can spend time pursuing other studies and other things. And that leads us into balance because I never had balance in the first part of my career. I realized I had the passion and I had the ability to imagine and I had the ability to prioritize and to discipline myself.
Sure.
But the balance was not favorable.
I think it's a mistake that a lot of us have made. I've struggled with that myself. Just so for our readers here, the book ABCs, A is achievement, B is balance, and C is contentment. So obviously the achievement, believe it or not, for my audience, is the easiest part.
Yeah, yeah. I agree with that. Although putting a film festival winner together, it only takes a million hours.
Yeah, and people don't realize how long a video takes.
No. An eight-minute video can take me seriously months.
Yeah.
And I cannot tell you, the video journal, I have to watch every single video from ESCRS, every single video from ASCRS, from Australia, from Brazil. It's a massive
amount of work.
That's
got to be hundreds, coming out of at least hundreds of videos.
Oh, every year, every year. So that takes a lot of time, and unfortunately, we get seduced by ophthalmology, and then we can't develop true balance. And that's why I put the B there, because I sat down and I said, I've got to become more balanced. Now, what can I do to become more balanced so I'm just not consumed by ophthalmology? Well, I've always liked fitness and sports. That's very important to me. I ran every day from age 18 to age 60, at which points my back gave out and I switched to biking and kayaking and some other things. But staying fit is really important. It's not an ego thing.
Sure.
Staying fit allows you to go into the operating room and work the whole day without fatiguing.
Sure.
Staying fit allows you to do things with your family. I saw you playing golf with your son at one of the meetings.
Yeah.
It allows us to do things with our kids that if we weren't fit, we might not be able to do. So fitness to me has been incredibly important. You mentioned coaching. I've coached 70 some odd teams. I'm still coaching. One of the local high schools called me a few months ago. He said, we can't find a qualified coach.
You're like, say no more. I'll show up.
I said, I'm in. It happened to be one of my granddaughter's teams, so it was a slam dunk. But I've taken teams to the national championships in AAU at Disney World. I have a Final Four with boys. I have a Final Four with girls.
That's amazing.
And I have Major League Baseball players like Kevin Youkilis that I taught how to play baseball for 7 years. They were on my teams. And that's very, very satisfying, is working with young people, whether it's residents in ophthalmology or whether it's young athletes. It's been a great part of my career and allowed me to get much closer to my kids, which was really the selfish part in this for me. I think writing children's stories. I used to tell the kids and the grandkids stories, and suddenly I decided, maybe I'll try to publish them. So I now have about 20 published children's stories, and every penny from those goes to wonderful children's charities in town. So I think that adventure, I used to go to a meeting, I fly to Australia, give a presentation, turn around, fly right back. I put 100,000 miles a year every year.
Wow.
Argentina, fly back the next day. But then it hit me. To achieve balance, that's not very good.
Correct.
It does help you if you want to develop a deep vein thrombosis in each leg. But if you want to develop balance, then it was fantastic. I changed completely. I started involving my kids and taking them with me on every lecture. And I, so we've trekked through the Amazon. We've in Brazil, in Australia, we've gone diving through the Barrier Reef. I've climbed Mount Rainier after a lecture in Washington with one of my kids. I've gone to Africa after speaking in Cape Town and the magnificent safaris and whitewater rafting after speaking to the Canadian Society with my two of my boys. So by incorporating these things, it draws me closer to my family. Now, my kids may not recognize that, but it was all part of the master plan. And I think that balance is something that I'm still in pursuing. I have 12 grandchildren, and every single weekend, they are my top priority.
Oh, great.
COVID's been tough. We've had a difficult time taking them to movies and museums and gyms and everything else. But it's very important to me to spend that time with the grandkids, and that's all part of the master plan for the B in balance.
That makes so much sense. It's just, I struggle with the same thing where I didn't spend enough time with my kids. I did what you were saying. Fly into an international meeting, do your talk, and 12 hours later, you fly back out. probably spending more time on the airplane than you did on the ground at the host country.
Right.
But now I've changed my gears as well. I've changed it so that now I go to a meeting and I already incorporate either time to bring family or friends or loved ones, and also time to actually sightsee and enjoy, or as you say, have some adventures. And I've built some amazing memories. One of my favorite of all, you were mentioning South Africa. You know, I used to go with Spence Thornton. I went a couple of times with Spence.
I know.
I had an amazing time with him. And then there's another story in your book that really rung a bell with me, which is maybe 10, 12 years ago, Spence tried to get me as one of the members for the IIIC, the International Intraocular Implant Club. And it was shut down for whatever reason. And he says, Uday, I'm very sorry. I tried my best. I tried to get my friends to help me with this. And what ended up happening was basically like your story. You actually resigned from the IIIC.
I did. They turned down a very deserving cataract surgeon in the United States who has received the Innovators Award and a number of other accolades. But because he had a personality that incited controversy, he was blackballed, and that was more than I could handle.
Sure.
And I said, either you have a society that is set up to reward merit,
correct,
and you allow all deserving individuals in on that criteria alone, that they're deserving, or if you want to play, I don't particularly like the clothes he wears or the way he laughs or who he hangs out with, you know, then I don't want to be a part of that society. So I was the first one to literally walk away from the society. And I'm sorry, because many of my friends were there and many of my heroes were there when I first was invited to join. But I can't be a member of a society with that type of hypocrisy.
You're true to yourself, which is you know, to thine own self be true, right?
That was one of a number of things that I've done in my career where I'm not so sure that they were the smartest thing to do, but they felt right. And a lot of times, you know, you just got to do what's right. I did one of my favorite videos that I ever produced was called FDA or DWR. And it was, do you pay attention to what the FDA says?
Or do you do what's right?
Or do you do what's right? And that was a really wonderful video. And at the very end, I reveal what FDA stands for. For the first time, people knew that FDA means for development abroad.
But luckily, you became very good at smuggling. And so
I did.
So no, that's just fantastic. That's amazing. Lifelong friends in ophthalmology is a very important topic that you touched on earlier. And sometimes it's taken me 20 years to figure out that the people that I keep seeing at these meetings have become way more than just colleagues and associates. They've become very dear friends. And they really add to the beauty of the journey that we're doing in ophthalmology.
I don't have a lot of friends, Uday. I'm a kind of a reclusive personality. It might surprise you, but I'm very comfortable alone. I work into the wee hours of the morning. People ask, when do you sleep? If we saw a text at 2:30 in the morning from you, I say, it's no problem. I sleep during my first three cases the next day. I'm very comfortable alone. But I mentioned earlier the support that I received from Dick Lindstrom, Doug Koch, Sam Maskett, Roger Steinert, Alan Crandall, and then people who I've become very friendly with at meetings. Yeah, Graham Barrett is like, I can't tell you how much I adore Graham. And when I go to meetings and I see Abe Vasavada or Richard Packard or Fernando Trindaggi or Lucio Barato from Italy, I mean, you're absolutely right. These people I really enjoy. And it's not just when things are going good, when I'm getting some type of an honor.
Sure.
It's they're there to share it with, but it's when things don't go well. You know, 20 years ago, I was knocking on death's door with a pineapple-sized, highly malignant kidney tumor. And
you were exactly my age. I read the book. You were 53. That's right. It makes me think I need to go get a whole body MRI just to be sure.
This was pretty lucky. Golf saved my life because this was my first year swinging a golf club, and I was speaking at the Canadian meeting down in Tucson. And I practiced after my presentation at 7 in the morning. I practiced for 12 straight hours. That's the nature of the beast. And I was flew back to Cincinnati the next day. I was walking in, across the parking lot, kind of limping, and I happened to run into a neurologist. And he says, "Why are you limping?" I says, "Because golf is a contact sport." I overdid it. He says, "Well, come on, we'll get a quick MRI on you. I've got an MRI in our office." I said, "No, I don't think it's necessary." He says, "Come on, it's 5 o'clock. You don't have any patients." I went over, I got an MRI, and the next morning the phone rang, and it was the radiologist. And he says, "This Dr. Osher?" I said, "Yep." He says, "Well, I've got some good news for you." And he says, "You were right. That's just minor irritation on your back, and it's nothing to be concerned about." And I went to hang up the phone, and he says, "And now the bad news." I said, "Excuse me?" He says, "The bad news, you have a pineapple-sized malignant kidney tumor." Wow. So that set my world. That was on a Thursday or a Friday. I called all my kids in from around the country. I told them what the situation was. I made an appointment at the Cleveland Clinic, and Doug Koch and the people I mentioned were very helpful finding the top renal cancer surgeons in the country. They all came to my assistance right away because I didn't know anything about renal cancer. And I flew, I did all my surgeries on Monday. I flew to the Cleveland Clinic. I drove to the Cleveland Clinic on Tuesday. They repeated the studies and they flayed me open, took out my kidney, my adrenal, my rib, all my nodes. And, you know, they thank the good Lord. This was an incidental loma. It was purely because I was overdid it playing golf and I ran into a neurologist. This was God's doing. I've become a very spiritual person because I'm not a religious person, but I'm a spiritual person. Sure. I believe I had more to do and I was given the opportunity to do so. And I've never wasted that. It's changed my whole view on life. Now I relish seeing a hawk flying across the fairway. Sure. Or, you know, my wife is a magnificent wildlife photographer. I love seeing the tiger swallowtail or any sunset. It's just magnificent. And I so appreciate it. Whereas prior to that, I wouldn't have paid any attention at all. Sure. And the way I changed my relationships with my children, the way I reprioritized my whole life, because I wasn't going to blow this second chance. And I think that, you know, everybody should be so lucky to have a serious disease which is not fatal. And it does change your perspective.
Helps give you a reset.
Yeah, it's a total reset, complete reset. So that's when I really knew, that's when you really appreciate your friends. That's how we got into that, was sure. The tumor had gone into the capsule but not through the capsule. I was maybe a day or two away from inevitable death with no treatment. So, you know, I always will appreciate how my friends got me in right away and found the best places. And I do treasure those friendships.
Yeah, that's one of those things you just can't predict. It. I think certainly for me, after turning 50, you realize that I'm already playing on the back nine of the golf course of life.
That's right. Yeah, I always say the catabolic side of the curve.
True.
Same thing.
Yeah, and then I look to find the last part, the C, contentment. And that, to me, has been probably the most difficult. I think I'm my own toughest critic. I think I'm too hard on myself. And I don't think I allow myself to find enough contentment. That's something that I really struggle with.
The C, contentment, is definitely the most elusive. The A is easy. You roll up your sleeves, you work your butt off, and the A comes. The B is premeditated. It requires prioritization and discipline.
Sure.
Man, the C is elusive.
Yeah.
And I've hit the C. I know what contentment feels like. It's wonderful. Wonderful.
What pearls can you get for me to find my own contentment?
Well, it's no single thing. It's an accumulation of, it's like little tributaries coming into a wonderful, beautiful river. And the tributaries for me, you know, my practice, it became so satisfying. And when you do the best you can for every single patient and you look at yourself in the mirror at the end of the day and say, I took no shortcuts. I gave everybody the best deal I can. That's an awful good feeling after years and years and thousands of patients. And then my family, I did not have a great relationship with a couple of my children. And I changed that. I've got five incredible kids. My oldest runs one of the probably the most successful hedge fund in the country out of San Francisco. He's been number one in the country many times. My second is the busiest of our 12 retinal surgeons. My third is bought all these places in 2008 when the market went down, and he borrowed all this money, and now he is an extremely successful real estate guy. My oldest daughter is a nurse, a beautiful nurse, and she works at Cincinnati Eye Institute. So really, I'm now the third most popular Osher at Cincinnati Eye Institute, beside my son and daughter. And then my fifth is a wonderful guidance counselor in D.C. And I think that you're only as happy as your most unhappy kid.
Oh, wow.
And if you have, I redid my relationships. And I told him how much I loved him. And I told him that I made mistakes. Even in that book, it says, yeah, I have made mistakes with my family that I regret so deeply. But I think that, you know, we have a chance in life. You can't procrastinate because you never know what the next day holds. But while you've got a chance, it's really critical that you do tell those people and your family that you love them.
Yeah.
And I think that that gave a great sense of contentment. I think I also was very lucky because not everyone gets the opportunity to find a soulmate. And my Debbie Osborne is my soulmate. And you know, it doesn't matter what we're doing together, if we're together. Here I am over the Christmas holidays up in freezing Connecticut. We were supposed to be enjoying a lovely golf and fishing and biking and everything down in Florida, but we had a terrible storm in the United States and Delta canceled my flight. But I'm still happy as long as I'm with my Debbie. And I think that she, I hate to use a cliche, but she really completes me and allows me to feel that contentment. I think that we've talked about friends. We haven't talked about philanthropy. And I think it's really important that everybody has certain things that they can support and give back. My oldest boy does the Navy SEALs and he runs their charitable events. You know, each of my kids is involved in something and it doesn't really matter, but you gotta be able to give back.
Sure.
We're not selfish creatures. You have to give back. And whether it's with your time or with your money, you know, I think that produces a sense of contentment when you see that your time or your money are doing good things. You know, if when we're young, we have more time than money. And when we're older, we have more money than time.
Sure.
And we can do good things with that. And I think that in my situation, my mental contentment is that I'm still investigating. I'm still doing projects with the residents. I just did a textbook with Jorge Alio and Burkhardt Dick, which is a huge textbook, which is just released in Europe. You know, I'm involved in so many wonderful projects that I love. I'm putting together this video for the film festival. I've got my next column of the JCRS due next week. You know, the next issue of the Video Journal is due in the end of January. And then the meeting is cataract surgery is telling it like it is. It's in February. There's all kinds of mental things that I still really enjoy. But I have to now let the cat out of the bag. Because of balance, I love competitive golf.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. I took it up. I read 25 books my first year. At the end of my first year, I was written up in Golf Digest and added to the list of single handicap golfers in the United States.
There's that ambition again.
Yeah. Oh, I after surgery on a Monday or a Tuesday in the summer, I can go out to the golf course, get there at 8 o'clock at night, work on my chipping, my putting, my pitching, whatever. Wow. Until it's, and I see the sunset and I see the hawks and the deer and the foxes, and it puts it all together. But golf to me is so intellectually stimulating, as well as being a real mind game. You know, the hardest distance in golf is 8 inches between your ears. So I fell in love with that. I'm so glad I didn't do it when I was young, or else I would have given up ophthalmology maybe. But I think that everybody has to have hobbies.
Sure.
I love music. I play a little guitar, a little piano. You know, I love, I used to be very competent as a card magician. You know, we have to have hobbies. And now my hobbies are primarily my grandchildren. But when you put all this together in the package, Uday, the best thing about life is not the achievements in life, it's the journey.
Sure.
And the journey is so satisfying. And when you look and say, was this life a successful life or not? I think if you lived it to the fullest and you tried to squeeze every little thing you could out of it and you did the best you could, that's where contentment comes from. And I'm so, so fortunate to feel that.
Oh, that is beautiful. Well, I'm going to continue to follow you as one of your disciples. I'm still enjoying your journey in teaching the world how to do ophthalmic surgery. And hopefully I will continue with my own long journey in the ophthalmology world.
Uday, you've been a pleasure, not just on this interview, but watching your cataract coaching and your lecturing. You've contributed so much. Your residents are so lucky. Rumor has it that you won best teacher 5 years in a row.
I did.
Which I have not done.
Behind me.
So yeah, you've been, if you've been, it works both ways.
Yeah.
I learn a lot from you, Uday, and I'm very, very grateful that you allowed me to share this interview with your many viewers, and I can't thank you enough.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I look forward to seeing you in person very soon, and I promise not to challenge you to a game of golf.
And now the $64,000 question is, do you think the recording will work this time?
I bet you it did. So I think we're good.
Uday, thank you.
All right,
bye-bye. Thanks, Bob.